Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk Radio Show, sponsored by NASCA. My name is Penelope Bennett. I am from Bellevue, Washington. I will be your host this evening, and on my host team is Pamela Lockridge. She is not only an ambassador for the state of Louisiana, but she's also the producer of, or one of the producers of the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk Radio Shows. Tonight is special guest night, and we have a very special guest with us this evening. Her name is Susan Glandon, and she's from Owens Crossroads, Alabama. But before I bring Susan on and tell you a little bit more about Susan from her bio, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about NASCA. NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. Issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first being educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the second, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you're streaming in and you are interested in joining our panel, I would highly encourage you to do so this evening. No experience necessary, and Pamela will welcome you into our call. And you'll have an opportunity to ask our special guest a question if you wish. The number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. So being that this is a special guest night, as we begin, I will tell you a little bit about our special guest, Susan Glandon from Alabama, from the bio that she has provided to us. And then Susan will have an opportunity to come on and start telling us about her story. And we start through someone's story chronologically through their life, so beginning in their very early childhood. And we will end the show with where our special guest, and tonight it is Susan, where they are today and what they're doing. In between the chronology, we will break to the panel, and our panel will have an opportunity to ask Susan questions. And I know we all share similar experiences in our journeys, but I do ask, because this is a special guest night and it is Susan's night, that we craft our questions and comments around her story. So without further ado, I'm so honored, as is Pamela, we're both honored to bring Susan Glandon from Owens Crossroads, Alabama, onto the show. But before that, I would like to tell you a little bit about her. She came from a mostly loving family, but she was abused by her stepfather from about 3 or 4 years old, just after he married her mother. The abuse lasted my entire childhood, she says. The sexual abuse abated physically, but when I was 12 or 13, the physical, mental, and predatory abuse continued until she told her grandmother. So I'm going to stop there, and I am going to welcome Susan onto the show. Susan, you're on now. I've unmuted your mic, and welcome. Thank you for being here with us this evening.
Hey, Penelope. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. So, you know, we're very interested in hearing your story, and I know that you and Pamela had a talk before you came on the show, as she was talking to you about with the show and about special guest night. And so we do like to start in the early, you know, in early childhood, from your earliest memory, if that's okay with you. We're very interested in hearing about your childhood, you know, from about, usually the first segment we try and go from the earliest years up through about 10 or 13 years old. So if you're comfortable with that, I would just like to turn it over to you to tell us and everybody listening your story.
Sure, sure. My mother and my father divorced when I was 2, and after a very short courtship, and I just learned how short the courtship was during the Christmas holidays. I guess I had never asked my mother before how long she and my stepfather dated, and I was really kind of surprised to find out it was only 4 months before they got married. But, you know, a lot of times I think a predator recognizes if he's got a good thing or not, and if it's the right situation, you know, they kind of go for it. And almost immediately after they married, the behavior started, and my earliest memory is probably when I was 3 years old, no older than that. My brother was 5. My mother always bathed us together, and for some reason, she stepped out and left the job to, you know, her new husband. And right away, I distinguished the difference between her method of giving me a bath and his method of giving me a bath. And
oh, wow.
It was very shocking. You know, because a mom is very gentle when she's washing her children and, you know, cleaning their private parts, basically. And what he did, you know, was just I didn't know it was called violation. My vocabulary was limited, but I knew what he had done was wrong. I mean, it's kind of funny because when you're a child, you, even at age 3, you have a real sense of what is right and what is wrong. And, you know, what he did, of course, and, you know, she would take a washcloth and wash my genitals and stuff. And, you know, he used a bare hand. And then, you know, I don't know how blunt I'm supposed to be, but he, in total violation, you know, he inserted a finger in me. And, of course, nobody had – I'd never been treated that way. And implicitly, I knew it was wrong.
Oh.
And so that was just – that was the end of any ideal I had about him possibly being a good guy.
And
really
the end of your innocence.
Exactly. That's exactly what it does, and that's what you realize, too. I mean, even at a young age, you realize that. And then it's also, you know, it set me up from that age of knowing this is a person I better avoid at all cost. You know, it didn't appear to be an accident, not by looking at his face or the look on his face and... You know, it's amazing that a small child can read so much in one small gesture.
But that is very true, because children know. And that's why when they tell you something, even at the age of 3, you know, children do not lie about what happens to them.
Right. Right. We're surrounded by truth.
That's right, and you knew. And it sounds to me like at age 3 as well, because you knew that this was wrong, you lived in fear. You were on eggshells right then and there.
Yeah, you know, it just changed. It changed everything for me. And, you know, I know my brother was oblivious. He's a 5-year-old. Of course he would be oblivious. But from that point on, one thing I knew that happened immediately with me is I really wanted to stop talking. So I did have an emotional reaction to it because my brother started answering all, speaking for me on my needs. Like at the kitchen table, if I wanted salt or ketchup, I would kind of make a little grunt, and my brother would get whatever I needed because he seemed to know what I needed. And I kind of chalked that up to, I remember my parents struggling and, you know, with making me talk and making my brother stop getting me things. But I am sure it was just a response, you know, wanting to be quiet, you know, not wanting to be noticed. And then, you know, the cruelty, the other types of cruelty jumped in right away, too. I mean, my mother, I can remember at the same apartment, new apartment that we'd moved into when I was a small child, my mother started taking a night class. And I remember one rainy evening standing in a window looking down over the parking lot because I could see when she would pull her car in coming home from class. And he stood in the doorway behind me and said, you know, your mother's not coming home. Your mother's not coming home again. You know, I mean, who would even think to say something like that to a child? And I'm thinking he was probably at that time 21, 22 years old himself. I mean, that certainly is a large level of cruelty to aspire to. For when I look at 21-year-old men now or 22-year-old men, I would never think that they would go say something like that to a 3-year-old. But he did. So, and I was not his first victim. I can say that with certainty as well. His own sister was his first victim. And she later came out and, you know, told my mother the story of that 20 years later. You know, so it was a hard way to start, but, you know, one thing you learn, even as a small child, okay, the mechanism is let's not be at home as much as possible, okay? We have grandparents, okay? We have aunts and uncles. Let's stay all night. The first time that somebody asked me to stay over at their house, it was like, oh my gosh, I want to do this all the time. Okay. So on the weekends when I got old enough and had friends, I would either have a friend stay all night with me or I would stay all night with them. And then I would try to spend the whole weekend. If I stayed Friday night and we played all day Saturday, I would arrange it somehow to stay Saturday night. Because one thing is for sure, the abuse happens the most when the abuser is, he was also an alcoholic, right? So he drank a lot on the weekends, drinking lowers inhibitions, and that's when the events would happen. So I would just try to live away from home on the weekends and then pray for him to have to travel with his job or, you know, be gone, be busy, my mom be around on the weekdays. And I don't remember near as many incidents happening on the weekdays as they did on the weekends. But it was weird stuff, too. You know, if it was a weekend and they had a party happening and, you know, he would drink enough to sneak out of a party and come into a bedroom where I was alone and, you know, wake me up with an incident And it wasn't like he never had sexual intercourse with me, but it was always an intrusive use of his hands on my private parts. You know, and or me waking up and his genitals, you know, next to my face or on my face. And, you know, I learned as a child that, you know, the greatest thing, one of the greatest inventions I thought they ever invented, two of them, were the kind of pajamas that you could actually had feet on them and you could zip it all the way up to your neck, and my sleeping bag. So I would try to, I don't care if it was 100 degrees outside, I would try to double insulate myself with zipper pajamas and a zipper sleeping bag, anything to prevent this person from breaking into my private areas, you know?
Oh, you were absolutely, yeah. You were protecting, as a way for you to try and protect yourself, to, you know, put some layers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do want to actually point out something, and I want to thank you for, you know, obviously, my gosh, having the courage so far to just share what you've shared. And that just takes an incredible amount of courage. And I really wish to thank you for that. But I also want to, you know, make mention. So besides, you know, the guests that have called in to be on our panel, we also have, you know, we can have varying numbers of people streaming and listening in real time. You know, we don't know how many until after the show is over, but you are being heard beyond who's on the call tonight, just to let you know. And I mention that because, you know, you've shared so many things, but you've also shared about your sexual abuse, and you've gotten, you know, you've shared some detail, and I think it's very important because people need to understand that if it happens once, that's all it takes. The damage is done. It's immediate. There are different, you know, sexual abuse comes in many different, you know, forms. It's not always full penetration. So I think, you know, it's important to get that out there. It can be what you mentioned, you know, it doesn't have to be full penetration to be child sexual abuse. And I think it's important to bring that up. And I thank you for sharing that, because sometimes I hear, you know, we've heard some minimization. Well, it wasn't full penetration, or it only happened once. Well, there are many different,
oh, yeah,
as I mentioned, forms of sexual abuse.
Have,
and so, you know,
right.
I appreciate you bringing that up, because I think it's important to note.
Right. He actually, when I was in college and told my counselor, was in counseling, my mother had been told at this point, and they were getting ready to divorce, and he was trying to do anything to avoid divorce, but my mother was pretty adamant at that point. She talked to my aunt. My aunt had verified, okay, if she needed a verification, she got it straight from his sister. And they had one counseling session with my counselor. What you just said tumbled out of his lips, more or less. He said, it wasn't as bad as she said it was. And that was his explanation. And that was like throwing, you know, cold water on my mom and on my counselor, and a total admission, you know.
Yep.
Total
admission.
What are the varying degrees of bad, you know? No, anytime you violate a child, it's horrible. And there's not degrees of horrible. There's only horrible.
Like, you're not only a little bit pregnant, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and he was a trickster. The mental games that went with it, the physical abuse, the mental abuse. I mean,
yeah.
You know, my heart goes out to anybody. It is why I'm happy to do this and talk to you tonight and to whoever is listening, because whoever has gone through something like this, I mean, it's emotionally stunting. It's shaming to the person that it happens to, right? And the cloak of secrecy that you have to carry as a child that you're burdened with, it's incredible. It's just a dynamic that, you know, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. So, you know, I was fortunate because I did a ton of reading and I got counseling. And that was the key to any kind of survival.
Absolutely. But that, you know, but that is, that you're very much on point with what I believe in. And that is, sexual abuse, it's a crime. It's a criminal act. It's an act of violence against a child, but it's so much more than that. It's a death of innocence. It's an inability to trust any person, place, situation, or relationship. It's a struggle to really ever develop into a fully adjusted, right, person, being that there's been such a vicious attack on a child, and it's so destructive in so many different ways beyond the physical aspect, and you've been describing that, you know, beautifully, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, you're absolutely right, that's just, it's so much of what it is. And you know, at this point too, I wanted to actually bring on Pamela, my co-host, because I know you, the both of you spoke, and I'm sure she also has some questions and comments for you.
Sure. Yeah. First, I want to ask Susan: are you on speakerphone?
I am. Is that bad?
Well, I'm hearing some feedback, and you know, it's going to come out on your scan show when you try to listen to your scan show. So, if you don't,
okay,
mind,
I took you off. I did. I took you off.
Yeah. Okay, it sounds much better. Thank you. And yes, I'm here listening to your story, and I've, like I said, I've talked to you in depth, and you're doing very well telling it on the radio. I know it's different telling it on the radio than to somebody just one-on-one, but this is very important, you know, that we get this message out and that people begin to feel comfortable talking about their stories, because their stories are actually who they are. Who they were, okay? I mean, you'll always be part of your story, okay? And I was going to see if you would tell us when he stopped abusing you and what happened with that, what age and why.
Well, and I don't know if you're meaning the sexual abuse stopped around the time, well, gosh, I was still in high school when he was breaking into the bathroom and, you know, trying to look at me showering. Like, I would lock the bathroom doors and there'd be no lock on the bathroom door because he would pick the lock. And then he'd come in while I was showering and, you know, accost me about locking the door. You know, this is my house. You don't lock the doors. You don't have any right to lock that door. I'm going to come in here if I want to. And then there's me trying to learn how to, you know, then I am clever enough to figure out how to position towels over the top of the shower and then on the shower rack so that maybe I can duck behind the towels and hide. So there was still that type of voyeurism and sexual abuse going on into high school, okay? The mental abuse and the physical abuse, well, you know, I can remember, you know, when I was a freshman in high school, I had my first boyfriend, and same boyfriend all through high school. But boy, when I had my first real boyfriend, you know, the verbal abuse popped up, you know, saying if I did certain things, I was a whore, you know. I'm like, I didn't even know what a whore was. He did, you know. So there was that kind of thing. And Pamela, I think I told you,
in junior high, you know, it was trying to bribe me, trying to offer me money, you know, if he could see me naked and stuff. And I was disgusted by that kind of, you know, behavior. Believe it or not, I actually had this really great church family because I went to this, I was baptized in the Episcopal church and confirmed there, and I just had the nicest minister priest ever, and his daughters were my friends, and I was involved, and my mother was a Sunday school teacher. Now, I'll tell you an interesting story, and she and I have shared stuff through the years because she's had to release a lot of stuff too. When you're a mom who finds out that this man that you're married to, and I mean, I've had so many people say, "What, your mom didn't know? You don't think she knew?" You know, they want to allocate some blame there, but you don't know how professional predator is. You know.
Okay, Susan.
Yep.
There's other panelists, and we don't want to lose them.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm going to stop you here. Let them come on, and we can get back to your mother at that point.
And I can, and I will wander on. I'm sorry.
No problem. We just want to help you out with your show. Yeah, because the show does very fast.
I'm sorry. Yeah, no need to apologize. Because it's so important. It's an important part of our story, right? Because everybody's wondering, well, what about her mother? What about her mother?
Right.
So no need to apologize, because I'm sitting here thinking the same thing, and that's a question I want to ask. But Pamela is correct in that we do have a few panelists on the line that I know wish to say hello to you and possibly ask you a question. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to break to them, and then we can come back into your story. Is that all right?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. So I have Annie from California, who's a NASCA family member. And Annie, I'm going to bring Annie. Annie, you're on with Susan.
Hi, Annie.
Thank you. Hello, Susan. I wanted to tell you how much I identified with what you said. We have things in common. The whole bathroom abuse, that was a lot of what happened to me as young as age 3. And my dad wrecked the locks on the bathroom door so that you couldn't lock them. They were, like, taken out. And I remember as an adult going to that house and seeing that they were still like that. There were no locks on the bathroom doors. But as a little kid, he took them out. And I wanted to share that I'm afraid to take showers, and I do it, but I always feel fear. I never feel comfortable. And I just wondered if you have any residual feelings like that about the bathroom.
No, but I definitely believe in locks on bathroom doors, and you're absolutely right. In the second home we lived in and built from scratch, I was just shocked. I was in junior high. I was old enough to know at that point that all my friends had bathroom locks on their bathroom doors, and our bathroom doors did not have locks. Okay? So in a house built from scratch. And I could not for the life of me figure that out when I, you know, became old enough to become aware that everyone had locks on their bathroom doors. I mean, it's a privacy issue, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, thank you.
Yeah, and I hope everything is going well with you, Annie.
Oh, thank you. It is. I'm doing very well. Thanks.
It's a struggle. I mean, it's an ongoing work. Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why they call it a journey, not a destination, right? Okay. Thank you, Annie. Thank you. For being on our panel, and I'm going to put you back on mute. And I also would like to introduce Nancy from Georgia. She's a NASCA family member. And Nancy, I'm going to unmute your mic and bring you on with Susan. You are on.
Yes, hi. Good evening, everyone. My name is Nancy V. Brown, and I am a NASCA member. You know, I just wanted to say that I really just wanted to send out my love and respect for you for sharing your story and your testimony with us. I know it's not always easy, but, you know, I'm just grateful that you have the strength to share it. And I did want to say, I was a child who went through sexual abuse with my father. And a lot of the abuse did happen in the bathroom. So there were a lot of things I was able to relate to in this story. But also, I did want to just share that, you know, a lot of people who have been through this type of abuse have been through other abuse mixed with this abuse, but also, you know, how it affects their life, how it affects, you know, teenage pregnancy. I had my daughter, I was pregnant when I was 14, going on 15. You know, you enter into toxic, abusive relationships, drop out of school. There's a lot of things that happen to people who go through this, and that's why the suicide rate also is so high in that particular community. So, you know, they lack the ability to problem solve, and you get just scattered, and it's a lot to juggle. So everybody handles it differently. But again, I just wanted to tell you, thank you for sharing your story. And thank you for being strong as you're sharing your story and just praying
Nancy,
that God continues.
Thank you. I want to tell you that I became a teenager mother too. I was a mother, you know, by the time I was 18 years old. And, you know, I think that what happens with us is there's just such a struggle with self-esteem, and then we're looking for love and support, and we shouldn't have to be. That's something we should be getting at home. And when we don't, you know, we're just, and somebody looks at us, you know, sideways, we just think that, sorry about that, somebody looks at us, you know, and gives us the slightest bit of attention, we fall into that trap. And I fell into that. And, you know, I've done that a few times in my life. I mean, I've had a couple marriages, a couple divorces, not always been in healthy relationships because I didn't know how to think highly of myself. You know, you're right. Suicide, drug abuse, prostitution. I mean, people that have been in our situations, we've had to struggle the full range of, you know, where do we get our self-esteem? Okay, the father that raised us was supposed to care for us, adore us, esteem us, you know, tell us how to choose somebody good. They didn't show us how to choose somebody good, really quite just the opposite. They taught us how to choose somebody bad, for sure.
I agree.
So,
absolutely.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. I remember you sharing your story on the show. I believe I was your host, and you really appreciate you calling in tonight and supporting Susan and Nancy and Annie as well. I've heard Annie's story, and Annie's been on our panel. You have amazing support tonight, Susan, and I know that you're being heard, and there's a lot of empathy from the panel. So, Nancy, thank you, and I'm going to mute your mic now, and we'll bring you back on in the next round.
Thank you.
All right. My finger will work. Sometimes my finger doesn't quite work on the screen. So, Susan, I just, you know, I do want to, before we go into the next segment, let you know a couple things. Number one, I'm also the time lady. I feel like I'm always the time lady on the shows because 90 minutes seems like a long time, but it goes by really fast. And we are already in 35 minutes in to the show. So we have less than an hour left already. And so I also want to share with you, though, you know, you mentioned regarding, you know, the locks on the bathroom doors, and there are things that, you know, just stay with you. And for me, that resonated with me because I was molested in my sleep by my father it started about the age of 3, but I still can't go to bed at night without feeling scared, and I'm 51. So these things do stay with you, and it's constant work.
Right.
So you're not alone. You're not alone in that is what I'm saying. You're not alone in that at all. So Pamela had And Pamela, maybe you can help me out here. And I know that I know in your bio we talk about your abuse starting at 3 or 4 years old. There's some mention about the sexual abuse abating physically when you were about 12 or 13, and then other forms of abuse continuing. So, and just in terms of just the chronology, if you could help us understand from, you know, the age of 13 on to the age of 21, because I know it mentions here that there was more abuse that continued from 13 to 21, and that 21 you were suffering from severe PTSD. So maybe you could just help us understand your story up until that point and maybe a bit beyond.
Well, you know, I guess in some ways the abuse never stopped, because even though I was older, and I think that he was afraid somehow I would tell, you know, they have ways to keep you silent. You know, it was always the threat that my brother and I would end up in a foster home, and, you know, my mother would be on the streets if, you know, if I ever told anybody. It was always, you know, it would be me destroying the family unit, right? But how the abuse continued was not only with me, but through friends, my little friends. And, you know, Gary was his name. Gary wouldn't put an arm around me or a friend without doing that arm around you and touching your breast on the opposite side, right? Sexual abuse. I mean, that's what that is. And so I did get pregnant and married and had a child at 18, was out of the house going to college. And, of course, that imploded because I was managed to marry, surprise, surprise, an alcoholic, okay, who I was going to college and he didn't want me going to college. So when I moved home during some summer breaks from school, you know, I got scholarships to go to school. I got loans, grants, the whole gamut that a student gets. I can particularly remember the summer before I told my mom, him just verbally harassing me. We had never talked about, I had never confronted him about the abuse. Instead, just always avoided him my whole life, trying to just stay away from him. Thinking that, I don't know if your self-esteem becomes so bad that you just think nobody's going to believe you if you tell. Another tactic that he did very well in my childhood, I started having to hear him say to people, even my mom, my grandparents, that I had a problem with lying, like I had a problem with the truth. I never had a problem with the truth, you know, but now that when I got older, I realized that he did that because in case I did tell on him, that could be his backup. Oh, well, I've always told you she had a problem with the truth, right? So, you know, I just remember being in college, being home one summer. My mom said, why don't you come home this summer? I'll help you with Kara. That's my daughter. And you can work your job. You know, I always had a summer job. And I'll help you with Kara. And you can just kind of relax this summer. Well, he was in the house still. So I thought it sounded so good because in my mind mentally he wasn't there, you know, because I'd been away from him for a few years. Oh, what I didn't realize is that he was worse than ever with his alcoholism and with the way he treated my mother, the way he was behaving towards her. I can remember being in the kitchen washing dishes one day, and I don't know where my mother was, but she was probably outside in the garden or doing something in the yard. And he starts ranting about what a horrible mother I am. Now, imagine that. I'm trying to graduate college. My daughter's going to start kindergarten the same month that I graduate college in August. And I'm under stress and pressure from being in a household with him coming in the bathrooms, even when I'm in college, me locking the door, him picking the lock and wanting to come in and get something out of a closet. And there, the closet's right where you can like look right into the shower. And I finally turned around and said to him, if you just don't get out of here right now, I'm telling mom what you did right now.
And I mean, it was like I looked in his face. I mean, it looked like I'd thrown the pot of hot water on him this time. Okay. His bloodshot red eyes. He turned tail and ran out of there. But I mean, that didn't really comfort me. You know, my heart rate, I'm sure my blood pressure at that point was off the hook. I was at home suffering the same abuse at age 21 that I've been suffering, you know, my whole life. So, you know, I went back to school, and that's when the post-traumatic stress just started hit. You know, I had never, until I said those words to him, I had never, ever spoken of it. Not to anybody. Not to my best friend, who's been my best friend since I was 11. I didn't tell grandparents. I mean, he had me so quiet and so blocked down that it was pretty incredible. But as soon as I went back to school, oh, it's like some kind of, you know, the thoughts, all the old pictures of what he had done, the images of the sexual abuse, the torture, the, you know, horrible things that he said and did. I mean, I just started reliving every single one of them. And until that moment, I had been able to really suppress. I mean, I had been the queen of suppressing all that stuff and just trying to drive myself forward and make myself some kind of a life for my daughter and I far away from him. And so when I went back to school, that's, you know, I didn't know what anxiety and panic attacks were. And I started having them. So I thought I was dying from something. Okay. And I went and checked into a hospital by myself. Didn't tell anybody I was going. Let them do a lot of tests on me. And finally had a doctor who came in and said, you know, Susan, we're doing all these tests. I can't find anything wrong with you. But I see, you know, what your stress level is. I see that you're sick and you're not eating. And he was the first person ever that asked me, did somebody do something to you when you were a child? Were you ever, you know, abused? Mm. Or, you know, I don't even remember the exact words he used, but boy, then he opened it up, right? Because I didn't know, even though I confronted my stepfather during the summer, that confrontation was done that day. I shut everything back down. But I guess the stress of my senior year of college and everything, it built up. And I admitted to the doctor, I said, yeah, yes, I was sexually abused. He's like, well, Susan, this is what I'm going to do. I want you to, I found a counselor for you at your university. This is a woman that you're going to start seeing because I'm not going to keep you in the hospital any longer because you don't have something that I can cure, but she can help you with. And that was my first introduction to counseling, to knowing what had happened to me actually was abuse and somebody verbalized it. You know, we are talking about 1981 and 82. The information out there was so scant. I don't know if I'd ever heard the word child abuse or child sexual abuse. So, you know, that finding a good counselor at that point was really a lifesaver because I couldn't live every day with the level of anxiety and the pressure. And, you know, I had OCDs that were developing. Like I couldn't be around knives. I couldn't have any knives in my house, honestly, because I was afraid I was going to take a knife and kill someone.
Mm-hmm.
So, without counseling, you know, you just don't jump past PTSD or PTSD and OCDs like that. So, gosh, you know. I'm kind of, talking about it, you know, makes it kind of raw, but in a good way, it makes it raw, you know, because I was just a child and, you know, to survive all that, it was amazing.
Do you look back?
And that's when the abuse stopped, because
survive?
I didn't.
Right.
I'm sorry.
No, go on.
Well, that's when the abuse stopped, because when I checked out of the hospital, the first call that I made was to my grandmother. And I told my grandmother, my mother's mother, who I was very close to, I told her what had happened to me. And she turned around and called my mother. And my mother had an immediate meltdown and called my aunt, who was one of her best friends, called my stepdad's sister. And she, within 5 minutes of my mom telling her what I went through and what I was talking about, she broke down crying and said, well, he did that to me too.
Mm.
So she had almost immediate verification that he was the bad guy. And I think she knew that. But, you know, she'd been married and divorced already once. And I think, you know, we're from a small town. I think there's a lot of stigma for her. And she totally was in a codependent relationship with him. He was totally an alcoholic, but he was a functioning alcoholic who made a decent living. And, you know, she could overlook the alcoholism part of it because alcoholics were big in her life. Her dad, you know, was one. So she was kind of used to that, and
right.
She's since been remarried for 30 years to somebody that I love dearly, you know, who is truly a good stepfather, you know. So,
I'm glad you have that.
We still talk. I mean, you know, because the mother, my mom is a lovely woman, but sometimes she's like, plays the victim, and you have to go, Mom, you know, yeah, you were a victim, but you're not. And, you know, you just have to be aware of what your relationship was with him. And he was a horrible person, and there's not really much a woman can do to change a man who's a horrible person. You know, she feels like she failed at different junctures, but he failed. He failed everybody.
So, you know, as you're talking and you're doing such a stupendous, amazing job of telling your story, you really are. And you're just, I mean, I feel like she's getting it all in there. I mean, I can relate to like what Annie said. I can relate to so much of what you're saying, and you're just really doing an amazing job. First of all, I have to just applaud you for your courage and everything that you've been willing to share. And, you know, a couple things you said just really resonated with me. And you're welcome. And one of them is, and I remember discussing this in my own counseling, sometimes I felt like the suppression of the truth of what happened to me. And you just described this, you know, all of the things that were bottled up inside you, right, until, you know, you started having this severe, you know, PTSD and, you know, you were hospitalized. And but I think that subject came up about the suppression of the abuse almost being more damaging than the abuse itself, right?
Oh, yeah.
The suppression of it, the secrecy behind it, because until you can let it out, until you told your grandmother, and you did such a beautiful job of just kind of laying out, you know, the timeline and all of the different points in the timeline. But, you know, until you start getting it out in counseling, telling family members, you know, breaking the silence, you know, that suppression, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And what you described as well, I mean, the suppression has been in your family unit, in your family of origin and extended, right, and to other family members for so long. It was so big. The moment you had the courage to finally speak your truth, finally tell your grandmother, your mother finally heard, you know, then your mother's sister. But then the moment that you told your truth, you gave other people in your family permission to the same, and more came out and more came out. So the suppression of it started to release, right? Not only in yourself, within other people. And I just think that's amazing. And the fact that you took the first step is amazing. You know, you're really a hero for your family. You really are, really in so many different ways. But I also hear, you know, your mom, you know, I heard you say sometimes you can play the victim role. I feel like there's still a little child inside all of us, you know, that abused child that no matter how old we are, you know, our parents need to be our parents,
right.
You know, and need to, there's still that little girl inside, at least inside me. And I feel like I hear it inside you. We need a parent to still comfort that child, right, and still be the parent. I think kids need to be kids, and parents need to be parents. So, and I think you really described that very, you know, very articulately, and I really could resonate with that. So I thank you for that.
Well, I got to tell you, I think as victims of child abuse, we learn how to put stuff in a box. You know, it's just something that we practiced for so long. You know, let me put this incident in a box and put it away. But the truth of the matter is how destructive that becomes. In my teens, I was, of course, when I was young, the drinking age was 18. Okay, so there were times, believe me, I was always working, I was always going to school, but did I ever drink too much? Oh, you betcha, because drinking is definitely a coping mechanism, okay? Drinking, smoking, you know, escapism, you know, there's all these amazing things that young people can find to do as an escape to not look at what's happening. But basically, what we don't realize when we're doing that at that age is we're just doing more harm to ourselves, just doing more harm.
I agree.
You're right. I'd like to say that I always had a healthy escape, and my church was a healthy escape, okay, sports, and, you know, even my daughter, healthy things revolved around that. But when the pressures became too much, I knew where to find the escapes as well.
I hear you on that one. That's also been a topic that always, you know, that it always comes up, you know, the fact that, you know, there are tools that abuse survivors use to numb themselves. And while they may have been helpful during the abuse, you know, there's this impasse where then they become, you pass it and pass, and then they become more destructive as we become adults, and they need to be addressed. So,
right.
I believe at this point, I'd like to break to the panel, and I just bring on Pamela first. Pamela.
Hello.
My co-host. There you are.
Hey.
Yeah. Hi. You're doing a great job filling in all the details, and that's what we like. You know, to people to do. And I think, Susan, I think as you tell your story, you kind of remember things that even you need to, you know, may need to kind of put a little tweak on. And you know, I was telling you earlier about narrative therapy, where you go back and you know, some therapists will take clients through narrative therapy where they reframe the story, have the client reframe the story and look at the story in a different frame. And by doing that, it takes the pain and the hurt and twists it into, you know, finding meaning and purpose, you know, not that you wanted to go through it, but that since you have, you know, you're now getting beyond it, right, and getting past it and dealing with it in real time and getting on a healing journey. And it sounds like you're well on your healing journey. How far would you say you're, like, I always look at the healing journey as, like, you're not yet on it, then you get on it, and then you get on the other side where you're actually advocating and you're, you know, you've dealt with it, you're not having as many bad feelings. So where do you think you are? Are you on the path, or you think you're further along on your healing journey, like the other side?
Well, now, I'm not quite understanding what you're asking, Pamela.
Okay.
Can you?
Well, some people you talk to that have been through the abuse, it's like, no, I can't. You know, I have some people that I've actually invited on the show, and they'll say, yes, I'd love to do it. And a few minutes later, I get a text,
I don't think I can do that.
I understand that. I mean, you have those moments. Even I had those moments, you know, where you're just not, you know, I guess that's that unsure of yourself thing. But I got to tell you, if you're asking, if your question kind of revolved around the therapy and where you're at, well, I can tell you one thing that helped me with the anger part of it, and I don't know if it's referred to anymore as gestalt, and I don't even know if that's the proper term for it, but one of the best parts that I remember of that I had, you know, my initial therapy was just being able to take a plastic softball bat and, you know, beat the heck out of pillows and sofas and and things in my therapist's office. She'd be like, now just go to it, you know, and I would start. And I mean, I'm telling you, I would continue. And I know I sent you a copy of what I refer to kind of jokingly as a book. I don't know if it's not, you know, it is a book, but it's not like a big book. But I wrote everything out because everything for so many years just kept going around in my mind, you know, and the different incidents. And I really wanted to be able to put it down so that, you know, it stopped just running around in my head.
Right.
But I didn't I was just going to say, I didn't do just 1 year of therapy. You know, I did therapy. Then I always joined groups. I went to Adult Children of Alcoholics, if I can mention them. I did 10 years pretty much nonstop of different types of therapy just so that I could have some peace and calm around. I mean, because when you turn 21 and then all of a sudden you let yourself have all these memories and you realize that the first, you know, 21 years of your life sucked, okay, basically, you know, you're like, okay, I can't have the next 21 years suck. They have to be, you know, I have to be in some kind of control here, you know. I know control is kind of just an image sometimes, but at least I wanted to feel that way. I wanted to have some kind of guidance and, you know, and, you know, God did that too. So,
right. So we kind of all go through the same path, Penelope. You kind of sense that we can all tell by the way each other talks kind of where we are in the segment on the path, right? Are we just taking a step onto the path and then taking our foot back? Do we get on the path and we're starting to walk and we're picking up speed? You know, and then at one point we're just like, yeah, this feels good. And it gets the treadmill going, you know. And
right.
Yeah, you told me, Susan, you had, 10 years from the age 21 to 30 of therapy. And, you know, when I talk to you, you're like, yeah, let's do this thing. As far as the show, some people I can't keep, they're like, you know, let's do this. I'm ready. I'm beyond ready. You know?
Well, and the thing that you really realize when you get to be my age that I am now is that how silence, you know, I still like, I'm like you guys probably, okay, you got a Facebook page and you talk about certain stuff on it. I don't talk about, you know, anything about that, about him and what happened on my Facebook page because I still have like, you know, I have cousins who are his nieces, okay? They're some of my best friends, and I still feel protective of them. Like, what if all of our mutual friends started seeing, you know, every now and then, just a couple times. He's been gone a long time since in the 90s, okay, late 90s. And, you know, like, when we're all together, they know about him, but it's never talked about. You know, there's just things that you just don't talk about.
Well, that's the problem. That's why NASCA exists, is we want to get our guests and educate the public.
and make this thing something, because we have to talk about it. Families are going to have to talk about it. That's how we're going to break the cycle. The cycle has to be broken, you know? And I'm going to stop here because we have other panelists and our time's getting low. It's going fast. We've got less than 30 minutes. So I'm kicking it back to Penelope. Thank you, Susan.
Yes. Yep.
Thank you, Pamela. And I know time fly does fly. We've got 29 minutes left, believe it or not. And I would like to bring on Annie from California. So, Annie, I'm going to unmute your microphone. And, Annie, you are on. Back on with Susan.
Thank you. Hello again.
Hi,
and
Annie.
Susan, I heard more commonalities between us. I, too, was a teen parent, and I went to college anyway. And I'm so proud of having done that, that to this day I wear my college ring, because I feel like that was such an effort and so worth it that I didn't let having a baby stop me from college.
Right.
And, but I wanted to share that in college I had panic attacks. I remember hiding places because I was afraid. And I also had fantasies of stabbing people. I wasn't afraid I would do it. I actually was fantasizing about it. So I have that kind of in common with you too. It's really interesting.
Panic attacks are they're just, you know, when you're that age, when you're in college, and all the stress is anyway, and then, you know, it truly makes you feel like, you know, you're at death's door. You know, the heart rate, the stomach aches, the, you know, the everything that comes along with it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and it is an amazing feat for us to get through college and have that perseverance. And I think that's just the survival part of us that is saying we want something different. We want something better. We don't want to go through what our moms went through or be put through. You know, if we have this independence, I always thought if I had a college degree and my own job, then I'm not going to be treated like that by anyone.
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
I will not be dependent. That's one thing. I, you know, my stepfather always made it very clear that my mom was dependent on him. And, you know, he was kind of right about that.
Yeah.
So, but not right enough that he should have been doing what he was doing. I mean, he was just all wrong.
No excuse for his conduct at all, right?
No.
Annie, I wish to thank you for coming on again, and Susan, and I'm going to put you back on mute if that's okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Annie. And I'm going to bring Nancy Brown, our NASCA family member from Georgia, back on. So, Nancy, you're back on with Susan.
Yes,
hi, Nancy.
Hi, Susan. Good evening again. I did just want to talk about, I could relate to a lot of what you were saying, of course. And one of the main things that I want to talk about right now was really triggers. A lot of times you may be further along in your journey, but something may happen that may be a trigger. And those are things with the pandemic and everything going on that we may not be able to really have much control of. But it is important to speak now. And like you said, on social media, that is a really tricky, you know, place for me as well. So I understand, but you just have to keep in mind that there are so many people that are waiting to hear you share your story, and they're going to start to inbox you or connect with you or ask you to share it somewhere else because people are committing suicide. And that was the day, probably about 2 days after Thanksgiving, one of my sisters committed suicide recently.
Oh.
And that was a trigger for me because the abuse was from my paternal side. And they're younger than me, okay? She's 30. And, she was 30. And, you know, had I spoken, had I told, you know, you keep protecting the abusers. And while we're doing that, we don't really realize that literally people are, like, going through internal guilt and fighting their own internal battle because of that secrecy that you're sworn into family. So there's a lot of things that you, a lot of points that you made that I could, that resonated in my spirit. So just wanted to say thank you again for sharing.
Well, and it's kind of funny that we talk about this too, as far as the family, the Facebook thing, because although I've been very careful with my stepfather's nieces, who are my cousins to this day and my friends, one of them has a daughter who has gone to college and got a degree in counseling. And do you know, when she discovered I had written, you know, the book, and she found my page, and she actually gathered all of her siblings together and her cousins by the other, you know, I have two female cousins, all their children, there's five of them. She gathered them all together in a group to explain to them what Gary had done and who he was and what had happened. I mean,
wow.
And this girl is really,
wow.
She did that when she was like 22 or 23 years old in just the last 2 years, you know, and it lit the hair on fire of some family members, like their grandmother, who was my predator's sister. She didn't like it. Okay. And from what I understand, you know, my cousins, who are the mothers of these children, they were not thrilled that this happened. But Caitlin actually had the maturity and the insight to gather them all together and say, I'm going to have this talk with you about who, you know, Grandma Gwen's brother was and what he did. And to this day, I haven't, we're friends on Facebook. And we see each other, but to this day, I haven't asked her about, you know, what all they talked about. I just know that they had the talk, and, you know, I just had such a level of pride for her, because in a way, that is kind of stopping the cycle, isn't it? She works with abused women. That's her thing in life now, is she works with organizations that do nothing but help women who have been in abusive situations. And so, I don't know, did she come by that, you know, how did she come by that genetically? She's the person in that family that was going to turn all that wrong around? I mean, she has. She's done it, you know. So, I'm very proud of her.
Absolutely.
Well,
that's
Nancy,
amazing.
I want to thank, yeah, that is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. And she's going to have people lining up at her door for her services. I mean, seriously, she's incredible.
Yeah.
And Nancy,
yeah. She's going to do good work in her lifetime. Yeah.
Yes, she is. She gets it. She's, wow.
She gets it at a much younger age and, than I did.
We need more of her. But I also wish to thank Nancy for joining the panel and to share what she just shared. And I can't think of a more – that's a very powerful example of why it is so important to break the cycle and how, you know, it takes courage and how important it is. And Nancy, I also just want to share my condolences for your loss.
Oh, your loss. Oh, my goodness, Nancy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
We don't need more loss.
No, we don't.
We don't.
So thank you. That's why it's great worth sharing.
Thank you for having me as well.
Oh, well.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for supporting Susan.
Yeah.
I'm going to put
you
back on mute. And then, Susan, we've got 20 minutes left, and I really want to turn it back over to you because – you have written a book, 18 Years, Childhood with a Sex Predator. And so I want to hear more about that, and I want you to tell Pamela and myself, our panel members, Annie and Nancy and all those listening, about your book and where you are today and what you're looking to in the future. So I'll hand it back over to you.
Well, I can tell you that it's just a pleasure to be here and talking to you guys tonight, because it's almost cathartic in itself to kind of hear from Nancy, hear from Annie, hear from you, hear from Pamela. You know, I mean, that it, to me, with you all, it just feels like more of a support group, you know? I mean, what we've all gone through, you know, it's made us stronger, but that doesn't mean that every single day that we don't need encouragement and love and, you know, respect and validation. You know, those things are so important. And, you know, I guess I wrote about my experience to get it off my chest, one, and two, because I think that it's an ongoing daily struggle that we have. We have to address it. It's going to come up in one way or another, in a thought or an action or in something that somebody does, like, you know, a visit, you know, a bathroom makes you feel a certain way, or a lock on a door, or, you know, there's just so many connections to our childhood. And so all the healing that has to be done, I think it's just ongoing healing and not ignoring it, because if we ignore it and we don't work towards the healing part of it constantly, then I think it's too easy for us to backslide. And backsliding involves, you know, negative thoughts about ourselves, or you know, maybe even in some cases, you know, feeling sorry for ourselves. Why did this happen to me? Instead of, what can I do to make sure this doesn't happen to somebody else? And that's my total motivation for coming on. I didn't hear any stories of child abuse when I was growing up. I didn't know what that was. I remember in high school one time sitting at the table with my grandmother and the stepfather and my mom, and just barely, I was probably doing my homework or something, and then they're having an adult conversation and talking about, oh, some guy in town has been accused of doing this, you know, to his daughter, and all of a sudden my ears start perking up, right? Because this might be that subject that I've been hiding all these years. Well, then my mom looks point blank at me and says, well, if anything ever happened like that to you, you'd tell me, wouldn't you? And, you know, she always had this way. She's still to this day very, you know, bold and out there. And I just almost wanted to, you know, again, I just kept that super poker face. Because I'm like, you're really asking me this in front of him, and I'm really going to sit here, and his eyes are glaring at me, because this is more of a conversation that my mom and my grandmother are having about something they've heard about in town. Now, that's the first time I ever heard a conversation about sexual abuse of somebody in a family, okay? And then my mom is boldly asking me, well, I'd tell her if anything happened to me, wouldn't I? And I got him sitting at my right hand, you know, looking, shooting daggers through me. Like, you know, this is a time you better stay quiet or else, you know. I'm like, ah, you know, and call it what you will, but, you know, we just didn't have anybody talking about it. No, that was the only conversation I could ever remember. And I was silenced before I had a chance to talk. You know, I knew what the circumstance would be. And I had told Pamela earlier, you know, he would do things. He tried something with my brother once, too. Let me just throw that out there. My brother, such a good man. He's 2 years older than me. Well, you know, he told me in adulthood that, you know, when he was like 12 or 13 years old, that Gary came into his room and had been drinking. And I don't even know what it was that he would have tried to do with my brother. But my brother said he started throwing fists at him. Okay. He just like started punching. And he said Gary left so quick that, you know,
his head spun. So, you know, girls in the family alone aren't the only one. If you have a truly super predator in the household, I guess Gary was, you know, open to preying on anybody, any child that he could. But in my brother's case, he picked the wrong child. And I would have never thought about throwing a punch at somebody because girls are taught to be, you know, we're supposed to be sweet and nice and compliant and, you know, that kind of thing. Watch our manners. But my brother at 13 years old, you know, he was full of raging hormones, and I'm sure he was halfway angry at the world anyway because, you know, having been raised by an unpredictable alcoholic, and he was more in touch with his emotions, and he let fly, you know. So boys,
so Susan,
I'm curious
how old your brother was when he disclosed this to you. I'm curious, how old was your brother when he disclosed this to you?
Not until I disclosed it to the family. So when he and I had this discussion,
right,
probably a couple years after, when we were alone at some point, he was probably 25 and I was probably 23. And,
so, you know,
just to let you know how my brother talks, he said, I would have knocked his effing head off. You know, he said, I was ready for a fight. So my brother wasn't a real big guy, but he was pretty intense.
So, you know, it's interesting because you opened up the dialogue, your brother was able to share with you the fact that, you know, he had actually had an experience as well with your stepfather.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we know from the statistics and we know from, you know, other male voices of our NASCA family members that have come on the show and told their stories. But we know, not that it's not hard for women, because it is, but it's really hard for men to come forward because they feel, and I'm going to quote one of our NASCA family members, a male that has told a story, you feel like you have to be macho. You feel like you know, to even disclose this is weakness. We're supposed to be strong, you know. We're supposed to not show that side, you know, that stigma of not being emotional. And so we've heard that it's harder to disclose sexual abuse from men. And sounds to me like you gave your brother permission by sharing your truth. Your brother finally was able to share what had happened, his experience with you. And it sounds to me like he still was sharing some of that bravado as well. And I'm wondering what if you've thought about that a little bit too.
Well, all I know is my brother, just to this day, he hates him with a passion. You know,
yeah.
He has probably I don't even know if what I have is hate. I'm sometimes not in touch with my feelings in that way as much as he is. But I can tell you he's, and I don't know that it's healthy or not, but he's never had a good word to say about him, you know. And he can be pretty, he's a little different than a lot of guys. I mean, he's been married to the same woman since he was 26, 27 years old. And, you know, I don't know, he's always had a certain maturity about him and definitely a certain openness with me. We're the only two in the family, brother and sister. And I think he just hated what happened to me. And, you know, I think there's times that he probably, you know, if Gary hadn't drank himself to death, I'm just kind of glad that did happen that way, because I was always a little in the back of my mind worried that my brother, being a, you know, we're from the Midwest originally, and he's a big hunter, and he has guns and things like that. And, you know, it wouldn't be a far toss for me to, you know, think that my brother might have wanted, you know, to set things right at some point, you know, if God hadn't done it. But thankfully God took care of things, you know, and you know, my brother could remain clean hands. you know, because it must have weighed heavily on him.
I think that's, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because I think, you know, there is a lot of guilt that we carry even as siblings. We know that our sibling has been abused and we were not protective, right? Which is, I think, is another assault on children because children shouldn't have to protect their siblings. The parents should be parents. The parents should be protective. You should be raised in a secure environment. You should be nurtured, like you said. You should be esteemed. You know, you should be all those things. And children should never have to step up into those roles, no matter, you know, when they're children. Children should be children. So I think it is so, you brought it up, it's so impactful on the siblings as well, whether they are abused or they witness the abuse.
Well, and I think it's just very telling when I was just a little in shock at just this past Christmas when I said to my mom, and I don't know why I'd never asked her this before, hey, how long did you and he date before you got married? And when she told me, oh, you know, we only dated a couple of months and he asked me to marry him, and then we got married right away, I was like, but you know what happened? Where there she is, divorced with two kids, moved back home with her parents who still had one adult teenager at home. So now in a very small place, instead of there being three, now there's six people. My mom was not educated. He came along. He had a decent job. He really, you know, here's the funny thing. He always acts like he's pretty crazy about my mom, abusive alcohol-wise, not physically abusive to her. He, if anybody did anything to my mom, oh my gosh, he would go knock on somebody's door if somebody wronged my mom or said something about her behind her back, because we were from a small town and, you know, she had been divorced. And I can remember one incident where, you know, some woman around town had said something derogatory about my mom, or the fact that we kids had a different last name for a while than he had. And, you know, I can remember him storming over there with the whole family in the car and, you know, trying to chew on her. But that was just, now when I got older, I realized that's just his anger issues, because he had those too. Okay. But I think that he had my mom snowballed pretty good, because he was always pretty respectful to her face. Now, what we found out he did behind her back, you know, that's a whole different thing. Alcoholics and alcoholics, they're going to do whatever the heck they want to do, whenever they want to do it, with whomever they want to do it. And that was him. So, thankfully, when she found out, to her credit, to my mom's credit, and to the credit of our relationship, I mean, thank goodness, because kids need their moms, too. And at 21, throughout your adult lifetime, it's nice to have your mom on your side. And, you know, when she found out truly the person he was, she told him, you got to leave or I may stab you to death in the middle of the night. And it was just, and it was as blunt as that. So he left. And that was within months, a month, maybe 2 months max of me telling my grandmother, my grandmother telling her, you know.
You know, it shows that predators are really, really not as brave. I mean, they're brave when it comes to children, but when it comes to another adult, knowing what they've done and threatening them, oh boy, they're ready to haul it. You know, I've heard.
Oh, right, he was a coward. You are right.
They're all cowards. Yeah. All the predators are cowards.
They are.
But cowards.
Yeah, and he was too. You know, he could confront somebody who was not as big as him. Like you said, children, women. You know, you never saw him confront. I don't ever remember him being in confrontational situations with other men. Other men were drinking
buddies.
Your mother,
her mother bear skills kicked in, and she probably looked at him what was in her eyes. He saw the mirror of his own death in her eyes, which, you know, I mean, she would have never done it, but he didn't know that, you know, and that's why some of these women, they need to, you know, I hate to say it, get some kahunas and stand up to these men, because they're just cowards is what they are. They're cowards. And we need,
right.
as women who are going through domestic violence, need to know that. We need to stand up and stop being wimps and calling ourselves, you know, oh, just, we're such victims. Yeah, we're victims, all right, but then we need to, when we get past it, we need to get mental health and get healthy, and then we need to stand up and get in their faces. That's just all we need to do. And they'll run.
Absolutely.
They'll go.
Right on. Right on. And, you know, she needed to protect herself. Like, I needed to protect myself. We all needed to protect ourselves from him, and he had to go. He was the odd man out. He was the bad guy. He had to go. And that's what we did. We got rid of him. Nobody liked him and wanted to have anything to do with him, even in our small town, you know.
Yeah. I could just see a tribe of people coming together surrounding that person. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Just visualize it in my head. A tribe of people, you know, just surrounding him. And
yeah, but unfortunately in our small town, we still kept a lot of it all secret to ourselves. We kept it within our family boundary. You know, we could talk about it with us, but my mom finally did. Hey, I'm going to give her a little credit here. She finally got, it only took her a few months to get so ticked off about it that she called his boss because he had a job traveling. When you think about it, a guy that's traveling and he was going in overnight places and, you know, who knows who he had access to, drinking. I mean, she called his boss on him, you know, and, he was already struggling with illness at that point. Okay. So, but his illness, believe me, was from his drinking and killing himself with what he did.
Susan, we're really down to the wire. I'm going to kick it back to Penelope, and we want to end on a good note. So,
okay.
well, thank you, Pamela. And no, thank you, Susan. I mean, there's been a lot, you know, obviously, you've shared so much with us tonight, and there's been a lot of good dialogue, a lot of great questions from our panel, and some sharing from our panel. And I, you know, which I do want to, again, recognize our panel and thank them for coming on this evening. But especially, I do want to thank you because as you stated, it's the silence that enables the abuse to continue. And coming on the show, on the NASCA show, no matter, you know, I know we talked about, you know, where are you on the spectrum of healing, which I think is a very complex question. And I don't even know if I'd call it spectrum because sometimes I feel like it's a roller coaster. But with that being said, I do really think that when you come on the show, as you have tonight, Susan, and you share your story, you're sharing it with the world. You're on public radio. The shows are archived, and this show will be archived, so you can listen to it. Your scan number 2601. So our 2,601st show, so you can listen to it again. But these shows are actually, because they're archived, we have listeners from all over the world that listen to these shows all the time, so the number of listens will go up. So what you've done is you've taken a huge leap today in sharing your voice and sharing your story, and I wish to thank you. And we've got 30 seconds left, and I just wanted to turn it back to you to take a few seconds to give us a few parting words.
And I just want to thank you guys so much, okay? And not only am I going to be a member, but I am going to come and listen to your shows and listen to everybody else. This is like a godsend. I thank you guys so much, okay?
Well, we look forward to having you as our NASCA sister and our NASCA family member, and we look forward to having you on the shows.
Thank you. It's so nice to meet you both. All of you.
So Susan, what would you like to leave with the audience tonight? What's your nugget?
Oh, that life is great. And you can't let anything like this that happens to you, you know, become a negative focus. You just have to every day work hard to take care of yourself and then take care of others every chance you get.
Oh, perfect. That is just absolutely beautifully stated. Thank you so much. Thank you for your wonderful words. Thank you for coming on this evening. And on behalf of NASCA, the National Association for Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, we wish to thank our panel members and all of you listening. And when it comes to child abuse, if you see something, please say something. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Blog Talk Radio.